Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Jim and Austin. I'd like to talk a little bit today about some of the restructuring and some of the concepts that are going on inside the U.S. military. Recently, we reported about the 80,000 that are going to be cut from the Army. And, Jim, you had some real concerns about what that's going to do to the NCO forces.
Well, what I pointed out in the most recent piece was the reduction in force for RIF is nothing new. In fact, I was in the Army in the early 60s for 3 years, just as they were finishing up with the 1950s RIF after the Korean War. And so I was getting firsthand, you know, feedback, as it were, from various, especially the NCOs, about what happened during that particular RIF. And then I heard about the one after Vietnam. I knew people involved in that. And then, of course, I knew because I also had friends who were RIF'd or got out after the Cold War. So I've been there before, and I hear a lot of people making the same complaints that they're going to get rid of the wrong people. Now, it's not that they don't know about this, but the problem is that it's difficult to avoid getting rid of your best people, because your best people are liabilities in peacetime. The basic, and they, in fact, there was a bit of research which we threw in that piece where they examined who are the high performers in combat. You know, the people everybody says, I want to be near that guy if the shooting starts because he does the right thing and what have you. It turns out these are the same guys who get into extreme sports or extreme criminal activity or drug addiction. Not all three, obviously. You can basically be a risk taker, which is how they describe them, without being a junkie or a gangster. But it's the same set of mental tools. And these soldiers tend to be impatient with the kind of bull that your Mickey Mouse, as they just still describe it after all these years in the military. And the Gary troopers, you know, the princess, the Pentagon princess and whatnot, both senior NCOs and senior officers are already talking about, you know, tightening up on appearance and, wearing the uniforms right and learning how to march again and stand around in formations and all the things the troops hate. And basically, let's play down all these combat capabilities, and let's just make the lives look good. And that's what's happening. I mean, it is literally happening. Articles are being written, speeches are being given, and pretty soon, you know, over the next few years, your best combat NCOs and combat officers are going to say, as they have said in the past, who needs this crap? And just quietly leave. And then the next time a war comes along, this is a particular kind of story the media never tends to pick up on in a big way. But in the military, they're going to say, God damn it, what happened to all those great guys we had, you know, at the tail end of Afghanistan or whatever? Whatever happened to them? And why are we stuck with these bozos who kept on getting people killed back in the day? It's an old story which, unfortunately, is being repeated.
Yeah, I can remember when one of the things that happens in some of these RIFs is that they'll just do across-the-board RIFs, and sometimes they'll lose specialties. I had a friend that was in Ordnance Corps that I had gone to graduate school with, and he came out back in the mid-90s, and then they called him back in after he'd worked for me for a year, and because they had lost everybody in his specialty, or they got to the point where it hurt. So I'm sure some of that's going to happen too as we go through these changes. Austin, what's your
what makes it unique in the Army is that in the Navy they don't lose their specialists like that. You know, their specialists are technical people, like people in submarine crews, people who tend the nuclear power plants on ships and things like that. You know, crypto, some intelligence specialties. these people always have a job in the peacetime military. Because in wartime, they do the same thing. But what's unique about the Army is your combat troops. And even with the smaller Army now, you have a lot of these guys, you know, there's thousands of them, the key people in combat. And it only takes a few people in a platoon to make all the difference. And generally NCOs and maybe an officer. When they're not there, you take more casualties and you don't get the job done. And it's very easy to lose them because they are, unlike in the Air Force and the Navy, these people can be a handful in peacetime. They're a lot of trouble. They talk back. They're basically, you know, troublesome. And the Army is in the habit, and when they're in peacetime, to look for peace, you know, in their own backyard. And they take nothing, although there are some people this time around because the Army has a created in the 1980s, you know, more of a more complete and accurate, you know, corporate memory of combat and combat operations. There are more people speaking up, but the overwhelming attitude is, no, we're going to do it the way we normally do. Nobody will say that. They simply say, you know, we're going to, you know, basically get rid of the malcontents, the troublesome soldiers, people are going to dress right, look right, et cetera. They're basically describing it without saying exactly what they're doing, what the end result of what they're doing is. And that's what makes it so sad. Oh, there will be articles over the next few years, even in the Army military journals complaining about that. That's what the people who complain about, that's what they get. They throw them that bone. But basically, you know, the caissons go rolling along as the song goes. It's in motion and it's going to happen. And, you know, it's a slow motion car wreck. We can all watch, but we can't stop.
All right. Austin, your thoughts on this?
I really don't have much to add to it. I think Jim's stated it succinctly, eloquently, and also with what historically has been the result of this kind of meat cleaver, hasty cutbacks. And a military is an insurance policy. That's what it is. And the kind of individuals that Jim described are very important pieces, very important people in that insurance policy. And it's there are defense planners, both civilian and military, and certainly commanders that are very aware of what Jim just described and those risks. And I know it's not just a hope on this. I know that those people realize it's part of their responsibility to try to protect as many of those high-quality and important soldiers as possible. But when the budgeteers, you know, it's the term Dan Beltway clerk, and the Beltway clerks have power, and inside the Beltway, they're going to do what the political and to some degree restrained by financial reality, the political dictates. Financial reality, and there you have it. Military now deal with it. So. I'm not adding anything really to what Jim said. It's just another dimension that there are people back there, and I understand that this is one of the issues that they're going to have to navigate as best as can be done.
Right. Now, another thing that we've written about.
That's not very helpful, is it?
No. I know. Well, I think I was talking to you guys before we went on air about a book that's been written by somebody that we know. Operation Anaconda, where in that book they talked about how some of our capabilities were being cut during the Clinton administration and how we went into Afghanistan, and that really affected how we were able to wage war in the first few weeks and months of that battle. And I'm sure the same thing is going to happen is that we're going to cut capabilities and we're, you know, people are going to pay the price for it as we start whatever next conflict we end up in. And
well, that may not be the case. One thing they are talking about is, you know, the new paradigm, you know, the new way of fighting wars, which emphasizes getting small quantities of highly trained and well-equipped troops to the battlefield early on before things get out of hand. Because actually the Anaconda problem, where basically they could not get a battalion of Rangers there fast enough to take care of the situation. They had to depend upon higher, you know, tribal allies who were unreliable on the best of times. They basically, a lot of tribal allies got bought off by the Taliban, you know, who knew how the deal worked. You had to have Rangers there who could not be bribed. And the Air Force simply would not provide or could not provide sufficient air C-17s or whatever to get them there in time. So that has been remembered. And there is at least an effort, a conscious effort, to see that that will not happen again. So progress is being made, but transport aircraft have never been sexy. It's always difficult to get Congress to appropriate money. The Air Force wants to buy F-35s. They want to buy warplanes. They don't realize that, you know, a C-17 will win a war in many situations where an F-35 will just be, you know, superfluous. But that's an argument that, you know, has been going on since time immemorial. But it has changed now in that people recognize the C-17 or the air transportation as more important than they have in the past. So progress of a sort.
Right. Now, the other thing that's happening is the concept of the air-sea battle. And like we were talking before we came on air, we all remember the air-land battle concept. But the air-sea battle concept has something to do, Jim, if I understood things
well,
right.
Well, basically, air-sea battle has been around for a while. They basically went public with it, or somebody leaked it, actually, at the right time when, you know, the cuts were in the news. Basically, the military is going to have their budget cut 10% over the next decade, which is actually a 20% cut because since the Cold War ended, or at least in the last 10 years, they've gotten at least inflation increases plus a little more. So they're going from a time of plenty, as it were, to a time of severe belt tightening. Now, the Air Force and the Navy were also being called upon to cope with China, as well as, you know, North Korea, which they've been dealing with for over half a century. But China is a new threat. And what they came up with was, well, first of all, they went on the basis that since the Korean War in 1953, the United States has said, all right, especially after Vietnam, I should say, but in Korea, it was MacArthur, after that, said the American general in charge of most of the fighting, the early fighting in Korea, said, you know, you shouldn't fight a land war in Asia. You know, this, he was saying basically there's too many Asians with guns, you know, it's a losing proposition. And we got involved in Vietnam, and after that said, remember what MacArthur said, he was right. You don't get involved in a land battle, land war, in Asia. So, as China grew as a threat, it was quickly realized that they're only a threat because their Air Force and their Navy is becoming more capable. Longer range aircraft and actually effective seagoing ships. And until 20 years ago, the Chinese Navy was basically a Coast Guard. A large Coast Guard, but basically they didn't go very far to sea. Now they are cruising off Okinawa, going halfway to Hawaii. They're patrolling with many other navies off Somalia looking for pirates. They are moving out, and they are making claims on coastal waters of other of countries in the area, which the locals will tell you is nothing new. China's neighbors have had a century-long vacation from Chinese meddling. Because before that, the Chinese were all, anybody lived on Chinese border, it was like living, being a neighbor of Russia. You were in danger of your mighty neighbor taking a chunk of your territory, which is how both Russia and China have always operated. Now China is out, you know, looking for chunks again. And the consensus on the American side was, well, we'll stop them with air power and ships. And air-sea battle basically is a more detailed and well thought out plan to do that. You know, basically coordination between the Air Force and the Navy, which isn't always available in the past, hasn't always been. But also making alliances with our allies there. Japan has one of the largest navies. I think it's still larger than the Chinese Navy. There. South Korea has a large navy and a large air force. We have some powerful allies out there. And we basically are talking to them, and they want to talk to us because they're the ones who are being, you know, threatened directly by China. And the idea is to coordinate everybody. You know, it's like a NATO. You know, make it so that in wartime you can pick up a radio and actually get through to somebody else. And you've all made little plans on, for example, Singapore has naval port facilities and repair facilities for warships, and they have airfields, and so it goes. Yeah. So all those, that coordination stuff is part of air-sea battle, and China doesn't like it, which is a good sign.
Right. Austin, you're... view on this?
Well, let's pick up a couple of things that we had. Gee, you know, this is stuff that we've covered on Strategy Page and directly, yes, indirectly, and many posts, but directly and many of our reports on China, Asia, several of my on point columns. I'd even point one. Dan, I'm trying to remember the, I don't have the exact date, but it's 2001. It might be April or May of 2001, and it's an early on point column of China's boisterous borders. It was a border tour. And I did another version of it maybe 5 or 6 years later. Now, Jim's talking about the powerful allies we have in the Far East. They're naval naval assets. Well, China's got, because this as China becomes more powerful, and as Jim says, 100-year, 120-year, 150-year hiatus in Chinese hegemony. Disappears and they become China asserts its power towards Southeast Asia and towards Japan, and heavens, remember they're still wrestling in domestically with Tibet as a province as far as Beijing, the emperor's in Beijing, and I use that pointedly. See it, but they are look around and they are ringed by neighbors who distrust them deeply. If I start with Vietnam, where the U.S. Legacy of Vietnam is extremely complicated, Vietnam War and the like, but we've watched this over the last 25 years. The Vietnamese are looking for want the United States to be a strategic ally because they see China strengthening, and China's their traditional threat. And just march on across. There's even cleavage, political cleavage going on now between Burma, Myanmar, and China. The China-India relationship, well, it varies. It's not good. China with Central Asian and Muslim former SSRs and relationship with Russia, they have overlapping interests. Syria being a recent example of Chinese Russian diplomatic cooperation, but it's an uneasy border. I mean, when you look and see that North Korea is your best ally. You see that China sits inside a nest of nations who are suspicious of China. It's one reason that Japan has built a naval force that is very extremely modern And the Chinese criticism of Japan is that the Japanese, particularly their surface forces, integrate very easily with the U.S. Pacific Fleet, and in terms of being able to share communications, targeting data, and the like. And that's absolutely accurate. In other words, you could see that the Japanese fleet is able to, you know, to share situational awareness, which means all kinds of intelligence and information connectivity with the U.S. Pacific Fleet on essentially the agreement by a couple of commanders. Shows you that U.S., as Jim pointed out, American naval resources in the Pacific vis-a-vis China are Chinese naval forces are they're far larger than they appear on simply a U.S. order of battle. Another thing that we've written about, and I think I can go back to 2004-2005, is this emerging, the Indians don't like the word alliance, not with the not with the United States. So they can book it with the Singapore, and there's plenty of cooperation with the Australians. Actually, there's a lot of cooperation with the United States. You've seen the Chinese perceive this as occurring. In other words, this old, to use a term that gets banged around the Internet, Anglo-spirit alliance, you know, all great United States, Australia, Singapore, and India were all British colonies. They have a speak a common language, English. They have very common interests in trade, and Singapore exists as an island of free trade, and they even though they seek a stable trading relationship with China, there is it's a common defense interest linking all four of those nations. How does this, but that's more at a grand strategic level, but this links into what Jim was talking about in air-sea, so-called air-sea battle on the Pacific littoral, but also extending on into the Indian Ocean. From a Chinese perspective, I'm just here, I've talked about this emergence alliance, they look at India as a big dagger sticking down in the Indian Ocean. And why is the Indian Ocean important to China? Why is Singapore and the straits there? Why are they important to China? That big, long resource line of communication all the way back to Africa and Southwest Asia. India, if a growing Chinese power begets a response from China's neighbors. And they look at the United States as a reliable ally, and as Jim pointed out, several of these Asian nations have their own interests in building up their naval and air forces to protect their sea lines of communication. So the picture I've painted actually is one that it makes some sense for the Chinese to build up their naval forces. Do you have an argument here for a arms race? That's part of what we're watching, I think.
Now, one of the things I'm curious about, Jim, with the focus on the air-sea battle, is that going to weaken our ability to wage a land battle?
Well, that's the intent of a lot of the cutbacks. The politicians want fewer ground troops, and the Army is talking about, you know, cutting 20% or more of their brigades, combat brigades, and the Marines are looking to be taking a similar hit. So there'd be less temptation to get involved in a land battle. Land battles mean casualties. Now, even though the casualties were much less, I mean, they were one-tenth of what they were in Vietnam, you know, in Iraq, and the casualty rate was less than half of what it was, you know, in Vietnam and World War II. There's still a lot of casualties. And as was a lot of people pointed out during the Gulf War in 91, there were so few casualties to say, this is going to become the new, you know, yardstick. why can't you do it like the Gulf War? Well, that requires a lot of special things, like if you're only fighting Iraqis, et cetera, et cetera. But the push is for painless war. It always has been. Sun Tzu, you know, and even Machiavelli, a lot of their wisdom was basically about how to fight a war without bleeding. And that involved using a lot of chicanery, you know, the mind games, et cetera, et cetera. The last thing you want to do is have a battle and have a lot of dead bodies. And that is indeed, you know, the best way to fight a war. If you can finesse the other guy, mind game him, whatever it takes, get him to make a deal or surrender or what have you, that is preferable to just, you know, slaughtering each other for months or years or whatever. So the idea is, if we're not going to get involved in those land battles, let's have fewer troops. The problem is, you don't always have the choice. I mean, before 2001, at 9/11, you know, Bush came in saying, we're not going to do any nation building, et cetera, et cetera. He wasn't looking for a land war in Afghanistan or Iraq or any place else. We were basically drugged into it. And that's the thing you always have to be concerned about. Not the war you might get into on your own, but the one you might be dragged into because of something someone else does. The idea is, if there are superpowers involved, there are built-in constraints, because the superpower means nuclear weapons, which is why Iran is trying to get a nuclear weapon so they can play the superpower game. Push and shove and bluff and what have you. The Iranians have for thousands of years been very good at that. But there are situations where you got to put, as they say, boots on the ground, and then those boots, you know, those soldiers are more likely to get killed or wounded. And this is something you, which is a good, you know, idea to avoid. And what China is mostly concerned about now, and they are shrinking the size of their army, is their overseas trade. I mean, the cornerstone of their economy is the ability to import lots of raw materials, oil and ores and what have you, and export, you know, goods to other countries. And they cannot guarantee that unless they can guarantee, or at least have a way to guard their access to the sea. Now, even the Chinese understand that the best way to do that is diplomatically, not militarily. You know, nuclear submarines have changed the whole business of, you know, mercantile, you know, shipping protection. It's a whole new ballgame. It's never been put to the test, but, you know, people in the Navy who have experience with operations on the surface or undersea can tell you that it won't be World War II, it'll be worse. So China has a vested interest in that. The problem is, China is not building a huge navy, they're just building a bigger navy, just big enough to make realistic threats on their neighbors whom they have disputes with, or islands in the South China. Actually, China has come out of that and said, the South China Sea belongs to us. And that includes any islands that anybody else might have a claim on. Forget it. Now, they haven't quite got the air and naval resources to actually go out there and push anybody else away. The locals, and of course, they are nowhere near having the capability of pushing the United States Navy away. But they're moving in that direction. And they're talking about fighting a local war, which will not involve nukes, which will basically stop before it gets escalated to the nuclear area. And that's the kind of war that we are basically trying to reform, rebuild our military to deal with. The idea is we will stop before we get to the land battle. Now, that basically precludes what might happen in the Korea if the North Koreans get lucky and get a lot of troops into South Korea, something which is unlikely these days, but they still have, you know, over a million people in uniform with guns. And then, of course, there's Arabia, where, again, the Iranians don't have nearly as much combat powers as they'd like the world to think they have, but they are a threat because they are threatening, and they have a lot of people in uniform. And if something like that should happen there, nobody expected Saddam to invade Kuwait, but he did. It was stupid. It was idiotic, but he did. That's how a lot of wars get started, people doing something stupid. And the Iranians, thank God, they don't have a history of stupidity, but everybody can have a bad day. And that's what we're worried about with Iran. And if they do have a bad day, the Arabs are not nearly as good fighters as the Iranians are. That's just a fact over there. The Arabs understand it. The Iranians understand it. If the Iranians decide to, you know, come south, somebody better be there to fight them, because the Arabs won't be able to do it. And that's the oil we depend on. So you fill in blanks.
Austin?
Well, yeah, we've been taking this kind of broad tour of Asia. I did a border patrol. Jim talked about the ways to accommodate growing Chinese power, and also we've been talking about ways that you might understand why the Chinese are, as Jim pointed out, they want a navy that's just strong enough to indicate what state their interests, protect their immediate interests, but indicate that if pushed, they might reach further. There's also another read on it too, is that because the Chinese own strategic discussion going on in China. They talk about the first island chain and then a second island chain, and there are a couple of maps of those second island chains that do extend deeper into the Pacific, almost, not quite, to Guam on one of them. And is that an expansionist China? Well, Jim's given a case where the Chinese want to, it's very Sun Tzu in some ways. This is it's talking about Machiavelli, but Sun Tzu, I think we want to succeed in our long-term strategic goals of economic modernization and wealth creation, and do it without risking a war that would that we might lose. That would certainly hurt us economically. So it's kind of a new configuration of Sun Tzu, saying the greatest commander is the one who never fights but gets his way without fighting. A Chinese Beijing is or Sun Tzu enthusiasts, so you can see that component in the picture that Jim just painted a moment ago. Look, I said earlier that you could see this as something of an arms race. As Jim pointed out, here in the United States, and I think so in Beijing, the current leadership understands in Beijing the costs of such a extensive arms race to achieve military domination, and the likelihood that it wouldn't work. Again, this, here's the counter reaction to growing Chinese power. I described that column written now 10 or 11 years ago about their China's border patrol. All of the nations that surround it are suspicious of growing Chinese power, and the Chinese are aware of that. They realize that their actions breed a counter reaction. So, air sea battle. I don't know. You take a look at World War II. We certainly fought an air, sea, and land component battle through out the Pacific. It brought us right to the littoral of Asia, and we ultimately ended up in that little corner of Asia, a peninsula, Korea, fighting a land war. And that land war isn't over, is it, Dan?
No,
it's still frozen there. I mean, Jim brought it up. That's the element of the Cold War that still hadn't gone away. And again, it's connects to where our forces stopped, and actually, well, the division that was existing in conditions out of World War II. And then I have some final statement about it, that, but, you know, to protect Naval and Air Forces, and here I am, an Army guy saying this, Naval and Air Forces, and in the Pacific are your primary military means because of distances and because of it's an Admiral's Theater, and it's Admiral's Theater with a reason. But here's the deal related back to the defense budget cuts. That's not the only place in the world. And by far it's not the only place in the world. And, you know, Iran is a different kind of presents a different kind of problem. And if you're going, you cut too deeply into ground forces, you're not going to be able to reconstitute them very rapidly. Come back from the Navy guy is like nothing takes longer to reconstitute than the naval forces. You're looking at 10, 12, 15 years to build up a fleet. So budget bet on this is that we'll build ship hulls and then hope that we can reconstitute infantry platoons if we need them. So,
right. Hopefully. Well, I think that's a good place to end. We've run to the limit of our time, and we'll talk to you next time, gentlemen.
Take care.
Bye, guys.